raised rowdy.
Do you split your time between Texas and Nashville?
No. I've lived here for 7 years or so. I was in Austin for a decade before that.
Okay.
But I'm moving back next month to Austin.
To Austin?
Yeah.
Okay, very cool. And you linked with the Heathens last year too. Are they in Austin?
Yeah, well, four out of the five are.
Okay, yeah, very cool.
One of the guys lives in Asheville,
okay,
North Carolina, but the rest of them live there. And Gordy Quist, who's one of the founding members, also has a studio there where I've done my last two records.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay, very cool. Why are you going back?
My son is a senior year.
Okay.
At University of Texas. I was gonna say UT, but around here that has a different meaning. a lot of family and friends, and
yeah, for sure.
Just another chapter in life.
That'd be nice. Is he a musician?
No, he's a magician.
A magician?
Yeah, okay, cool. He does magic. Although these days he's a journalism major, so he's more involved in current events and less in performing, but gotcha. He definitely has that bug.
Okay, very cool. Does that kind of run in the family, like the arts? What did your parents do?
Well, my parents were both attorneys.
Okay.
But my mom was a theater major and is very much has performing in her blood. And
okay.
I think that's probably where I got of my desire for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you, was there ever any like pressure or idea that you would go into the family business, like law or anything?
No, I was fortunate in a couple ways. One, my parents never really pushed me in any direction. They were pretty supportive of what I wanted to do. And I think my dad's just patient and in a way I'm not really, and was just hands off and let me kind of do my own thing. And then my mom was very encouraging of any kind of creative pursuit because that's what she loved. And even though she ended up in law, her dream and her passion was theater and literature and performing and art. So she appreciated that stuff in a way that she really supported me and encouraged me whenever I did anything creative. And
yeah.
So I got into theater really pretty early on.
Oh, really?
And yeah, I guess like seventh or eighth grade I started doing it. And then high school I really dove in. And
to the theater?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I played sports and everything. And I was decent, but decent enough to make a team, but not to star or even start in many cases. But that was just Texas growing up. That you play those sports, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But when I got into the theater department, there were girls there.
Yeah.
Which was, I wasn't having any luck meeting girls. Yeah. He is the backup, power forward on the basketball team. And there were just all sorts of folks that opening my mind to new things, that were reading books and taking in art and examining the world from a different perspective, a lot of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I love the sports. But it was kind of monolithic in a way. It was just a bunch of guys competing. And this was a different thing. And we would travel and go to other schools and see other girls and other people doing stuff. And it was so I dove into that. And by the time I graduated, I'd quit all my sports and was just studying theater.
Theater. So that was the big, art for you first.
Yeah, I think it was the first opportunity to perform and get on stage and get that rush of excitement of
people looking at
people looking at you, and you have a chance to impress them and do something. I was definitely hungry for that, trying to find some way to stand out and just be seen as more than average.
That
was a need of mine for sure at that time.
Was there any kind of role that stands out for you when you look back? I was young Scrooge in middle school.
Okay.
Like young Scrooge from his early days. So like before he gets old and mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the only thing I did. But just important as an example.
Part of his arc. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I played a choir director in our town. And I only remember that because two things. One, I had to learn to play the xylophone.
Mm.
And then secondly, there was this scene, and it was my most memorable acting performance, and that I was a drunkard. It was some foreshadowing. There's a scene where I just am by myself and stagger across in front of the audience on my way. And, it was quiet and still, and all eyes were on me. I was the only person there. And it felt like the electricity from that moment of having, you can hear a pin drop, and the only thing, whatever you're doing is going to determine how these people feel or respond. And so it was, you know, it was 15 seconds, but I still remember that feeling of walking across and going, all eyes are on me.
Mm.
And I have the ability or the opportunity to have a moment and make people feel something.
Sure.
And I have no idea if I was any good or not, but I remember that feeling, and I still get that, particularly when I'm playing listening rooms or things like that, where there's no better feeling than when they're with you and you've got them and they're listening to what you have to say. And you know, it could go south, but you have the chance for magic.
Sure. Every move you make, like however subtle, just has an impact.
Yeah.
That's huge. And that was all before music, it sounds like.
Right? Yeah, I had started playing guitar about 15, and a lot of my buddies in sports and in theater played, but nobody, none of us were particularly advanced or doing anything with it, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was one band in my hometown.
What was the hometown?
The Woodlands.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, cool. So I was born in Houston. My mom's from Houston. And I grew up there, and my dad's from Waco, Texas.
Awesome.
And they met at Baylor.
Awesome. Man, the Woodlands has blown up.
Yeah, when I moved there, there was 1,200 people, and now I think there's 120,000 or something. For those people who don't know, it's the Woodlands is a planned community. It was just a pine forest, and a guy named George Mitchell, who I think invented fracking, or... founded it, and so it's just a playing community, and it grew a lot.
Yeah,
when I was there, and when I left, there was probably 30,000 people, and now it's a whole thing.
Yeah, so you said there you picked up the guitar around 15. What got you into it? Like, were you immediately writing songs, or were you just kind of playing with buddies, or?
You know, I was writing songs before I learned to play guitar. I loved music. I loved humorous stuff. Like, that was the kind of thing, particularly at that age. One, I just enjoyed it, but also that was a skill set I possessed as a young person, not the ability to write with any depth, you know? I had a lot of pining feelings and, you know, typical teenage emotions that I wanted to get out, but I didn't know how to do that. But it came pretty naturally to me to rhyme stuff and to be able to write about something funny.
Yeah.
And so I was drawn to some of the Statler Brothers stuff. Kenny Rogers, while not at all really funny, had these great story songs.
Planet Texas.
What's that?
Planet Texas.
I had his greatest hits. That was my first cassette.
Yeah.
It was Kenny Rogers' greatest hits. And I just had we didn't have a TV, and so I just had a tape cassette player, and I had one tape, and I was kind of a latchkey kid, and so I would just go into the stairwell and put on Kenny and listen to The Gambler and Coward of the County, and Lucille, and these were epic sagas, you know, that rhymed and had like amazing language, and an emotional arc and a chorus that you could howl, you know, pick to find time to leave. It's like, oh man, I was feeling my 7-year-old feelings.
Yeah.
And, so that was a big one to me, that storytelling aspect, and I loved country music. That was kind of my main jam at the time, and early rock and roll, and so I was listening to stuff, singing along, and started writing songs to melodies.
Yeah, like
the first song I ever wrote was to Charlie Daniels' "Uneasy Rider" '78.
Okay, so you take the melodies and then write.
Oh, yeah, cool. I would write to that pattern, but I didn't have an instrument.
Cool. Okay. Yeah.
But you know, I just play with words and try and do something. And when I was 14, I think we would attend the Unitarian Church somewhat sporadically. And the Unitarians aren't known for their choirs, you know, so they would bring in like performers.
Okay.
And
like secular.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it was, one day they would have somebody come in and read Dante's Inferno. Okay. And then one day they would have a folk trio come in and play Bob Dylan songs. Hmm. And that particular day I was there when this folk trio come in and they played "Blowing in the Wind," "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall," and "The Times They're Changing." Mm. And I was 14, and it just blew my mind. Mm. Like, I already looked up the songwriters and musicians and singers and the idea of it. But then when I felt the power of those songs, it just blew my doors off. And so I asked my parents for a guitar, and they got me one for Christmas that year. Yeah. And so that's when I started picking. Got my Mel Bay chord book, learned a few chords, learned Camp Town Races.
Yeah, the basics.
And then I got stuck. You know, I didn't know what to do with these chords that I'd learned, and my ear didn't go to stuff.
Yeah.
But the big changing point for me was I got three songbooks, Bob Dylan, Willie Nelson, and Jimmy Buffett. Mm. And they just showed the chords. I knew these songs by heart.
Yeah.
That was my one skill, was I could remember all the lyrics to stuff.
Yeah.
And then when I saw where I was supposed to put my fingers, and then all of a sudden the whole world opened up to me.
Yeah,
like, I can play 1,000 songs with these four chords that I know. Yeah,
that's all you need. That's incredible. Dude, did you start playing for people like at that age? Or
I was the guy who, like, at the party was in the corner with a guitar singing the sad song about lost love, hoping somebody would think that. They're like, I don't know what I was hoping. Just like, I was hoping some girl would be like, oh, that poor guy.
You never know.
Yeah, it didn't work for a while, but I mean, you know, for a long time people would leave the room, you know, when I would play. But yeah, I was trying to, a lot of just doing it in my bedroom, but dreaming about somebody saying, hey, that was great.
Mm.
You know, and it was years before that actually happened.
Sure,
but
sure. That's awesome. And then you mentioned leaving the Woodlands. Did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to a school called Hendrix College in Conway, Arkansas.
Okay.
Just north of Little Rock. And I didn't know much about it. I was looking around in state and just ended up in this place that I had never actually been. They had a hacky sack club and a radio department.
Okay.
And as an 18-year-old stoner, I was like, that sounds cool, man. That's what I'm hanging out.
Some big check boxes being checked right there.
Yeah, it was a small liberal arts school, and I went there. I didn't know anybody there. Mm. And it was really good in a lot of ways, but the one that was maybe affected me the most was it was a chance to start over and sort of reset.
Mm.
Like, in growing up, I just never... I went by Josh. My full name is Joshua Hayes Carl. And you know, I never felt like I wanted to feel or fit in like I wanted to fit in. I was just trying to find myself and not doing well at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every year I'd come to school, like eighth grade, ninth grade, whatever. And I would tell the teacher, I was like, okay, I'm JC now. Or I would come up with some name. I was like, I'm going to change my identity. And therefore the guy that I was.
Yeah.
I can reset and
for sure.
And so she would announce it, and then all the kids at school would be like, "You're not JC, you're Josh, dude." So within a day, my plans would be foiled, and I would just go back to being how it was. And when I went to college, I started going by my middle name, Hayes.
Okay.
And nobody knew any differently, and nobody knew what a dork I had been, and mm-hmm. and you know, it just gave me a chance to kind of try on a new identity and see how that fit. And I liked it. You know, I wasn't a different person, but I just you know how you go through things and at a certain point you just realize they're not working for you. Mm. Certain behaviors or attitudes or whatever it is in whatever context. And that's just kind of how I felt growing up. It was like nothing's working.
Yeah.
And so going to a new place and being able to kind of start over was really big for me.
Sure. And so that's how it came about, Hayes Carl.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't think about it. I never seriously thought I'd be
in JC, the
music business, but yeah, JC was pretty fly.
It sounds like a guy who knows the answers, I think.
Uh-huh. Well, you remember, I don't know if you remember, but there was a rapper named Young MC.
Maybe vaguely.
Yeah, he was probably before your time, but he was like one of my favorite. Not that I had many rappers mm-hmm. that I listened to, but he was a kind of a pop mainstream
for sure.
Artist, and I was like, Young MC, that's so cool, and so I wanted to be Young JC, and that didn't stick either.
So at Hendrix College?
Yeah.
Did you start, was music a big part of your life there? Did you start playing out? Were you getting more into it?
I started, it was a bit of both. The downside was it was a dry county.
Okay.
So there were no bars, so there's nowhere to play.
Mm.
The upside was it was small campus. A lot of people picked guitar. I started playing more in my dorm or with other people, and it became just something that a lot of folks would do hanging out.
Yeah,
I was starting to get a little better, to where people didn't close their eyes and cover their ears.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and there were these opportunities to play. We had. They call them coffee houses. There were little events that would happen, and basically little talent shows. Mm. But it would give you a chance to go up and play a song or two in front of people. Mm. And I'm the first time I did that, I played a Robert Johnson song and a Bob Dylan song with a guitar player friend, and then that felt like okay, we just leveled up. Like and that was there was. 80 people in there and they didn't boo us and I was feeling pretty alive at that time. So
incredible. What were you studying there?
I was a history major.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
With no understanding or idea of what to do with that. I recognized pretty quickly all I wanted to do was sing and write. And I didn't have a way to do that as far as the performance part on any kind of real level. So I just sort of used it as a time to waste money on an education that I mean, I'm grateful for having, but it didn't really affect my employment in any way.
Yeah.
And I was a terrible student. But it gave me a time to sort of figure some things out and connect and make great friendships and figure out who I was and start to experiment with art and write some songs. So my senior year, somebody snuck me into a recording studio at 3 a.m. in the morning or something where a guy who worked there could get me in without anybody knowing.
Yeah.
And I recorded 6 songs. And I remember he brought me a paper bag a couple weeks later and it had like 10 CDs and 6 cassettes.
Shoot.
And then I was a recording artist.
Yeah. First debut albums. Can we find
pretty
it?
Pretty exciting. I think there's like one copy left and there's one song on there that's so mortifying that I hope it never sees the light of day.
We have a team we can track. Are there any songs from that time period that are out today on your albums that you're still play out? Like I wrote this in college and it's
I don't play them a ton, but there's, I think 2 of those ended up on my first record.
Okay.
One called Easy Come, Easy Go, and one called Lost and Lonely.
Cool.
And yeah, very yeah, cool. they took on a they've had a fun little life from those days to my first demo to or my first EP to my first record and then played them many times.
Very cool. And then after, did you graduate?
I graduated last in my class, but I graduated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Heck yeah. That's all you got to do. Did you, where did you go afterwards?
So after that, my immediate thing was I went to Iowa. A bunch of my friends and my future first wife, went to Scranton, Iowa to detassel corn.
Okay.
So it's kind of migrant labor stuff, but it's just a fun way to make a little bit of money. Yeah. Basically just walking around a cornfield and camping out for a month. And
when you're detasseling the corn, what is that?
In layman's terms. I wasn't very good at that either. But basically, my understanding is you're basically walking up these half mile rows up and down. So you're walking 25 miles a day, 30 miles a day. And you're just removing the part of the stalk. So I think they're trying to genetically engineer the corn to be a specific type, and you're removing some part of the pollinator.
Okay.
I'm sure if you got any corn
aficionados,
they're probably going to call in correct.
Our
correct
biggest
me
demo
here,
is a corn force.
Well, it's a market. And, so I did that and then moved down to Crystal Beach, Texas. So the Bolivar Peninsula,
cool.
Which is a pretty remote, isolated beach. If you go down to Galveston, which you know this probably, but for those at home, if you go to Galveston Island, which is an hour south of Houston, and then you take a ferry from across the bay, Galveston Bay, it's about a 25-minute ferry ride, drops you off on this peninsula, drive 15 miles, there's cow pastures on one side, the ocean on the other, and then there's a little town called Crystal Beach, Texas, and that's where I set up shop for the next 4 or 5 years.
How did you pick that spot?
Well, my folks had had a little cabin there that had been abandoned and they got for $25,000 or something just a 2-bedroom spot, and we painted it up and it just became a little getaway. And I had family that had moved out there, aunts and uncles and cousins, so basically it was a cheap place to live. While I figured things out, and what I decided was that I wanted to try music. I had no idea how to do that, so I thought, well, let me go live by the water. It was the cheapest beach in America, so it was like, you know, you could afford to live on not much. You know, property wise and probably just everything. So I went down there, started doing landscaping jobs and waiting tables and tending bar and then started picking up little gigs here and there.
Play covers in those days?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Pretty much exclusively.
Okay.
Nobody wanted to hear my songs. They still don't probably. Going down there.
Very untrue. So you were there, you said 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, I bopped around a little bit, but yeah, I was there for 2 years. Then I went and lived in Croatia for about 6 months. A buddy of mine was Croatian, and he had lived with me in the States for times during school, and so I went and I worked for the Census Bureau, made a little money, got the government job.
Sweet.
Went and lived in Croatia for 6 months, came back to Bolivar. And then moved to Austin for 6 months and just got my ass kicked. It was like I had nothing going on. I didn't know anybody in the music world. I just wanted to be around a scene.
Right.
So I tried that, went back to Bolivar, then spent a year in Galveston. So that was about about a 5-year period where I was kind of doing a lot of different stuff, but the beach was the home base.
Okay. And so when you're there, is the vision like, I want to get on the road, I want to be a touring artist and perform my original songs? That was kind of the dream?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it certainly got there. At first, I just wanted to play anything in front of anybody, anywhere.
Yeah.
And so there was a bar that I hung out at on my lunch breaks when I was doing landscaping. And one day I just went and asked the owner, can I set up in the corner here? You don't have to pay me. Just let me get a beer pitcher and put it out for tips if anybody feels so inclined. And he said, sure. And so I would do that. And I did do 4 hour gigs. And I was the only guy, I joke about it, I was the only guy who could play guitar and sing at the same time on the whole peninsula.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden there was a lot of bars on the peninsula. And so I started getting all these gigs. So I ended up, there was like 6 or 7 gigs. And so I could play every night of the week.
Yeah.
And, but no, they didn't want to hear my songs. So I would just do all covers.
But then after that, so the first gig that you got, I guess, doing the original music was with opening for Ray Wiley Hubbard, correct?
Well, I went to Galveston Island one night trying to go out to find a club or a bar with some friends. And that bar was shut down, so I was walking back to my car, and I heard music coming down the alley, and I followed it, and there was this little club, a 70-seat club called the Old Quarter Acoustic Cafe. And the original Old Quarter had been in Houston, and Townes Van Zandt famously recorded a live record there. And Rex Bell was Townes' bass player, and he was co-owner in the original one. It burned down. He moved to Galveston, opened up this smaller little folk venue.
Yeah.
And the night I walked in, there was an open mic night, and there was an attorney and a really beautiful exotic dancer behind the bar, and you know, nobody got paid there, everybody worked for free, and there were a dozen folks or so in there getting up and playing their songs.
Yeah.
And there was a shrine to Townes Van Zandt on the wall, and Blaze Foley and Lightnin' Hopkins, all of whom Rex had played with. And I said, can I play a song? And he said, yeah. And so I went out to my car, got my guitar, came in, and then that became my home for the next number of years.
Okay.
And I would tend bar there, hang out at the open mic nights. But on the weekends, they would have legitimate performers, touring artists who were on this circuit that I didn't know existed of small clubs across the country, across the world. And so Steve Fromholtz and Shake Russell and Dana Cooper and Sisters Morales and Vince Bell and Steve Young and Ray Wiley Hubbard and Guy Clark and different folks would come through there. And two of them took me out. Sisters Morales took me out to Houston and San Antonio and Austin, and Ray Wiley Hubbard did the same, and to Dallas and stuff. And so, yeah, I started getting to open for people who actually did it for a living and were actually making records and stuff. And so that was the big point for me, where I went from thinking, well, I'll just make a few $100 a week playing covers, to there's an audience out there that wants to hear original music and wants to hear what you have to say as a songwriter.
Yeah.
And these people are generous enough to take me out and put me in front of those audiences. And it was like, it was on.
Huge. Yeah. When you find out there's kind of like a middle ground between the playing the covers and then the people you hear on the radio.
Yeah, I thought you're either a cover band or you have a major record deal and you're on MTV. Like, I didn't know there was that middle ground.
Yeah.
And certainly growing up in the 80s and early 90s, where it was like, it's such a different environment now, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
At the time, it felt like there was major obstacles, and you had to have either incredible talent, which I did not possess, you know, vocally or musically, or you had to know somebody, and I didn't have either thing. But once I saw there was a path where you could kind of carve out a living if you could deliver, I got really excited.
That's a huge moment. So when you get out and you start doing that, do you have your first record out yet, or is it just
no? I made a little demo in a garage in like 99 or something, in Galveston, and sold a few of those. And but Lisa Morales from the band Sisters Morales, I would open for them and I was getting ready to, like, I needed to make a record, and I told her, I said, I'm just going to go do it in this guy's garage. He was a garbage man who had a little studio in his garage in Galveston. And she said, why don't you let me produce it for you?
Mm.
And I said, okay. And and that was a major thing for me, because she, rather than whatever crap record I would have made, sounding record, she took me to Pertinalis, which was Willie Nelson's studio. And we had Larry Greenhill, who was Willie's engineer. And then she got a bunch of professional musicians from Austin to come in and play. And so when I walked out of there, I had a professional sounding record.
Yeah.
And that record sort of led to so much of what came later. Not necessarily the songs having any success, but it got me involved with a small label. It got me involved with a publicist who later became a friend and introduced me to so many people in Nashville. It got me my name out there and got me on the radio. And those were things that I had no idea how to do and never would have probably figured out had I not made a decent sounding record and then had somebody pick it up.
Yeah. Would you identify like a breaking point, or not a breaking point, but like a make it moment, I guess, in your career, like a time that things started really taking off in a different way?
Yeah. I mean, there's been, I'm still waiting in some ways, you know, it's all relative, and it's all, you know, I've never had like a big shot that just completely changed everything, but I've definitely had some moments where I felt like
leveled up
and, one of those was putting out my first record and having somebody work at radio, or having seen articles get written about it. Like that was a huge shift from where I had been.
Sure.
And I sold none of it. Like the record did not do well, but it got me in the game, you know? So that was a big one for me. And then my second record, I self-financed both the records. I took out loans and just kind of bet on myself. The second record, I was starting to get some, people were starting to make offers for me and things. And I just didn't feel comfortable giving away any of my stuff or losing control. Cause I thought the only way I'm going to make it, it's gonna be a miracle if I make it. Mm-hmm. And growing up, I just read all the behind the music books about how all the, you know, Alan Jackson sold 6 million records and owes his label $500,000 up the numbers. But I just remember stuff like, how is that possible?
Right.
I'd be happy if I sell 600 records. Yeah. How do I not be in the hole to somebody?
Yeah.
And so I just held on to everything.
Yeah.
And, that my second record, Little Rock, I had a song called Down the Road Tonight that became kind of a regional hit in Dallas, North Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going from playing my record release show that had like 12 people at it to 3 months later playing in front of, you know, a couple thousand people singing every word.
Yeah.
And so that was a
yeah
a big moment where and also I put a band together for the first time.
Yeah.
And so now we're doing things differently. We've got electric guitar and drums and bass, and now the audience is swelling up. Not everywhere for sure, but in certain pockets, and I got my first taste of oh, that's what it feels like to have a bunch of people really enthusiastically excited about something you're doing, and not just, you know, a bunch of older folks who think of you as a clever little folk singer.
Sure.
You
know? That's a lot of words for an audience to know all of. There's so many words. So I was actually going to ask about that. Like, I mean, favorite song of mine, and it's just, I mean, is that a challenge ever? Like keeping all that just in your head?
yeah.
Like remembering all those.
Yeah, well, I have two songs, that one and a song called K-My Yo-Yo, that are just machine gun lyrics.
Yeah.
And both of them I've struggled with Now I can do them in my sleep as long as I stay on rhythm. But the down the road tonight, I remember this radio guy, the guy who owned the station, KHY, called me up and said, we've got a hit and you got to come play it. And I said, I've never played it.
Yeah.
I had written it in the studio just like as a word exercise. We just had fun with it. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you better learn it or there's going to be a riot. I was like, okay. So I wrote it all down on a yellow legal pad and I go out with a band for the first time.
Yeah.
And I didn't need any of it because they've been playing it like 8 times a day on the radio. Yeah. So that everyone in that audience was just had it dialed in.
Sure.
So it was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And with K-Mag, I remember I did Austin City Limits once it's a taping and we're doing it in the, I've done it twice, once in the smaller, the original room, and then once in the bigger one that has like 2,000 people. And the set's going good, but I play that song, K-Mag Yo-Yo, and I get to the fourth verse, and mess up. Mm. And I'm like, this is going to be taped for posterity. Like, Austin City Limits is a big deal. I can't do that. So I stop. The audience is very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do it again. I do it a second time. Same mistake, same spot. I stop. Now the audience is, they're cheering me. Like, they're getting behind me. And I'm like, okay, do it a third time. Mess up in the same freaking spot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just stop. Like, this is getting embarrassing. We go do an encore. We do the show, finish the show, do an encore. I come back out. I'm like, now I'm going to do it. This is going to be awesome. Same freaking thing happened. But this time I didn't stop. I just plowed through. And the audience never knew the difference. They went nuts. But anything where there's that many words, it can be, as long as I'm in the pocket with it, it comes to me.
Yeah.
If I get off beat sometimes, it can be a very scary place because it's really hard to get back on that train.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Wow. That's so funny. Was K-Mag, was that the third record, the third album?
That was my fourth
album. Fourth. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I signed a deal with Lost Highway after my Little Rock record, my second record.
Okay.
Which was really, that was a big level up for me too because it all of a sudden I went from being independent with some minor success and a little bit of touring history to being on a label with Willie Nelson and Elvis Costello and Lucinda Williams and Ryan Adams. And so Ryan Bingham and I signed about the same time and we were kind of the new crop of people. So I felt a lot of pressure, but also a lot of opportunity. It was very exciting.
What was your first album on that label?
Trouble in Mind.
Okay.
Which I think is probably my most successful record still to this point.
Mm-hmm. It gets a Grammy nomination, correct?
I've never had a Grammy nomination for
or for a song.
Any of my work, but Leanne Womack recorded a song called Chances Are, which was on my K-Mag record, and it got a Grammy nomination for Best Country Song.
Okay, yeah. Very cool. Trouble in Mind being the most successful, most recognizable songs, you'd say?
Yeah. It's spread out a bit, but that one's got Drunken Poet's Dream and Beaumont, which are two of my top three, probably.
For sure. Yeah. I was at Bobby's Idol Hour yesterday. Mm-hmm. It's a bar in town, and I was talking to the bartender, and he said, I love that song, but for a long time it didn't make any sense to me because I didn't realize that there was a Pasadena, Texas. So he thought the guy was walking California. From California.
Yeah.
That's funny. That song, you wrote that song solo, right?
Yeah.
Just solo. Is there I just love to talk about that song a little bit, just the story in it. Yeah. And just looking back, sort of how did that idea come to you, that theme?
Yeah, I signed with Lost Highway and I had no songs. I didn't have a single song. Which was pretty scary. And there's all of a sudden all these eyes on me, and I felt pressure. In my mind, everybody was like, who's this guy? And I didn't have anything to give him. So I started writing. I was living in Austin in an apartment and with my wife and my son. And that was just a finger-picking melody that a lot of how I write is just sit around and play and then either find a melody or just start spitting out words to whatever kind of tune I'm coming up with. Yeah. And I think that melody came first, and I just liked it, and that kind of rolling finger picking, and and I think the first line was, "I saw you leaning on a memory." I think that came to me first, and I just thought that's a cool image, and I like the way it's phrased, and then okay, well, with your back turned to the crowd, where are we? And the little bar on Murphy, what's happening? Yeah. That's the place they play guitar too loud, and so it just kind of one line after the other, for that first verse, and then Beaumont. I don't know why, but Beaumont is just always a town that shows up in my songs. Like one of the first songs I ever wrote was called "Birthday on a Bus to Beaumont." I was like 15, and I've got a couple more where I mention it. It's just a town in Southeast Texas that I've spent a fair bit of time in, but it's not. And a lot of great country singers come from that area. Mark Chestnut and Tracy Byrd and Tracy Lawrence and that Golden Triangle area. I don't know. Just something about the sound of the town that stuck out to me more than the actual town itself.
When you are writing a solo, just solo, and it's only you, do you feel like that's kind of your process, if you have one? It's like one line, next line follows. It's not really like start with an idea and how do we get there?
Yeah, I struggle to... I really have a hard time staying present and in my own mind. And so when I'm writing, if you and I were writing a song, having an idea, having a concept or a framework, that I can do that much better with another person.
Okay.
Because like I can't completely check out if you're sitting here across from me and we're supposed to be working.
Sure.
So I'm better able to focus on zoom out or zoom in and think of the thing as a whole. Mm-hmm. But if it's just me, I'm sort of just trying to do anything I can to stay in the moment, and I have a really difficult time with it. So I've got about 5 good minutes or 10 good minutes or, you know, whatever before I'm chasing something else.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I guess just the lack of discipline or self-control of being able to say, okay, I'm going to sit down and do this job, and that requires me staying at a 5 and not getting too worked up or overstimulated. And when I hear something I like, I get excited, and then I can shoot forward to, oh, this is going to be so cool, and wait till people hear this, and here's what this is going to make me feel, and then here's, I'll accept my award, and when I say it, when I do that, here's my speech, I'll give it. Like, I'm already, you know, planning my vacation house or whatever, you know, benefit is going to come from writing this thing. And then I'll look down, and it's like I've got one sentence and some mumbled, you know, words and a chord structure. So I have thousands of those things. So to answer your question, when I'm by myself, it often just comes, let me grab a line, let me play a melody, and just do what feels right. And then I capture that stuff all the time, pretty much every day. I'll just hit record and just go. And then when I'm on planes or have time to be settled or I'm heading into a co-write, I'll go through all those things and see what fragments are there that might be worth bringing to somebody to actually work on, not just get stoned and spit out, you know.
Sure. Drunken Poet's Dream, was a co-write with Ray Wiley?
Yeah, with Ray Wiley Hubbard, yeah.
Okay. Who brought that to the table? How did that come about? In the room.
That was, I guess I did, I had one line, which was, I've got a woman, she's wild as Rome. And I just always thought that was, it spoke to me. And I said, I want to use this somehow. It just felt very descriptive. And so Ray Wiley came over to my apartment, and I said, I got this line, I got a woman, she's wild as Rome. And he said, well, she likes to lie naked and be gazed upon. Oh shit. and so that's how we started it. And he left that day. We had a verse and a half and like a chorus. And then that night I called him up and I said, "Hey, Ray, I finished the song." And he goes, "I did too." And so we have two different versions of of the song. Yeah. Like I added a bridge, and he tells people I'm showing off because I added a bridge. And he's got some different lyrics in the chorus and stuff. But yeah, so it's about 60% the same. So I put it on my record, then he put it on his record. Then we did it together on a pandemic record I did. So we've gotten a lot of mileage out of it.
Yeah, for sure. Wonder if you could just talk about the Trouble in Mind up to the pandemic, just that era, and sort of what we were up to then.
Well, there was a lot of time in between because Trouble in Mind came out in like 2008.
Yeah.
But I did that, got a band together, started touring hard, getting to go out with people like the old 97s. I did a lot of work with Todd Snyder, opening for him. Just trying to build a touring career.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden the I was starting to sell records and get on the radio and again, it's all relative. It's like, but for me, it was definitely a much higher level than I had been at. Sure. So just trying to figure that out. I lost my voice around that time. But unfortunately didn't know how to fix it. And so I spent a couple years touring where I sounded terrible. I shouldn't have been out there. And I just had no range at all. No power. No.
What anything. Was wrong?
Well, I used to throw this little music festival down, in Bolivar, called the Stingery Music Festival, after a restaurant I used to wait tables at. And I did my record release for Trouble in Mind, and that involved 8 shows in 7 days or something stupid. And, you know, I drank a lot. I smoked a lot. I didn't take care of myself in any way. And I sang. I didn't know how to sing. You know, I'm just growling and hollering just trying to get some energy going. And at the end of that, I was just wiped out. A buddy of mine had to carry me off the stage, and I had strep throat, and then I got a steroid injection. And then 3 days later, I had to go throw this festival, the songwriter festival that I was doing. And I remember on that stage, I sang Freebird for some reason, just like 20 seconds as a joke. But during that time, I was like, I'm actually singing the shit out of Freebird. Like, my voice was incredible.
Yeah.
And it turned out it was that steroid shot making me think I could do things that I couldn't do. About a month later, I was in New York opening for James McMurtry at the Bowery Ballroom, and I went for a note and I couldn't get it. And then I don't know how much of it was just in my head or how much was physical. It was probably some combination, but definitely some physical parts to it. But I got to where I couldn't sing at all. The doctors equated it to a guitar, the sound hole on a guitar. That's your throat and your voice box and everything. And he said, yours, it's like you took the guitar and twisted it up and turned it over and tied it in a knot. And like, there's nowhere for that sound to get out.
Okay.
So that was a really hard time. Yeah. Cause all of a sudden I had a career and eyes on me, and my career was at its highest and my talent level was at its lowest.
Yeah.
And that was embarrassing and depressing to go out every night and people were like, who's this guy?
Sure.
Heard about it, and I'm like, so it was awful. So my next record came out, Yo-Yo. I recorded with that bad voice, and so I changed the way I wrote somewhat. There was some more spoken word stuff and just trying to find a range that I could operate within. And that record did pretty well. And then I left Lost Highway. They were kind of closing up shop. And Luke Lewis, the guy who was running it, called me and said, you know, you can stay with us if you want, but my recommendation would be go do your own thing, because the writing was sort of on the wall that they weren't going to be able to be there much longer.
Gotcha.
And so I was very grateful to that, because I didn't, I don't think anybody else in Universal under that umbrella at the time, I would have known what to do with me, or I would have, I don't know. I just, that was always my big fear. I didn't want to be trapped in some record deal that that I couldn't get out of with people who didn't care about me and didn't know how to promote me. So.
And then you launched your label at that time.
Then I did. I already started the label with Little Rock. It's called Highway 87 Records. And then I went and did a one record deal with 30 Tigers. We put out a record called Lovers and Leavers. There was about a 6-year gap in between there, a 5-year gap. I had all my vocal stuff. I got divorced. Just a lot of life. Yeah. And so then I came back and did that. And then that led me to, did a record with Dual Tone. Mm. I did 3 records with Dual Tone, actually, but one, and then the pandemic hit.
Mm. Yeah.
So.
Was that Dual Tone? And I know about the Nashville office. Do they have one in Texas too?
No. I was living here at that point.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. I left Austin, went to New York for 2 years, to be with my second wife. And then we moved here to Nashville, in 2017, 16. I think we got our house.
And having recorded in Texas and Nashville, and I guess New York, but I guess specifically Nashville and Texas is the most interesting. Is there like a different mindset when you're in the studio in those two states? Like, I'm recording in Texas, I'm recording in Tennessee, or am I overthinking?
I don't think it's the state as much as who you got there and who you're working with.
Yeah.
Because like, I've been in sessions in Nashville that are as organic as you can imagine, but I've also been in sessions where it's, you know, these guys are pros who are doing 3 sessions a day, and it's very much, here's our marks and we're going to hit them. And that's not a dig in any way on it. Yeah. It's just, there's a level of professionalism and proficiency that, is different than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Like, in Austin, it can be a bit more organic, but still people, I mean, amazing players and an amazing music scene. It's just, in all ways, Austin's just a bit more laid back and less professional.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's great. And sometimes you're like, man, I wish I had those guys who can just come and hit that mark.
Right.
But I don't know. I they're both amazing musical communities, and I love both of them. And so I just think there's more of the heavy hitters as far as studio cats and people who do this all day, every day here. And sometimes that can make a difference in terms of the vibe or how you're approaching things.
Yeah,
of course. When you're here, more so than Austin or anywhere else I've been.
That's fair. How did the collaborations with the Heathens start coming about?
Well, I the band of Heathens had been friends for a long time with them. They're a fantastic band, bunch of great singers, incredible musicians. And I had done 2 tours with them where they would open for me as the band of Heathens and then serve as my backing band, which is always fun for me to mix it up and, you know, try out new formats and play with different people. And so I loved that. And about 2 years ago, we did a little event in Luckenbach called Todd Hayes and the Heathens. It was Todd Snyder and me and band of Heathens. We had such a good time doing that event that afterwards we should do more of this in some capacity. Let's figure it out. And neither one of us, we were kind of mid record cycle. So we just went in the studio. Gordy has a studio, and we went and made a record. Our only requirement was, if it's not fun, we don't do it.
Yeah.
And so that was a fun way to operate. And to be in a band, I'd never been in a band before, you know, like where I wasn't the guy, and all the pressure and responsibility felt like it was on me.
Yeah.
This was something where I was like, oh, I've got 5 brothers and,
you
know, 2 other lead singers and I'm not responsible for all the songwriting, and they give me electric guitars and tell me where to play, how to play it. And so all of a sudden I was like in my late 40s, but felt like I was in my first teenage band,
right?
So that was really fun.
That's cool. I love Nobody Died from Weed.
Yeah,
I mean, I know I love all that stuff, but that song specifically is just so much fun.
Thanks, man. I wrote that with Driver Williams here in town. I do a lot of writing with Driver, and that was a fun one.
Yeah, that's a very fun one. And so that kind of takes us to this music, this new music, We're Only Human, mm-hmm. Which was written, was produced, you said, by Gordy, who was in The Heathens, right?
Yeah, correct? Gordy Twist okay. is one of the founding members of Band of Heathens.
Okay, very cool. How long have you had these songs for?
Not long, I guess. The last couple of years, I started, a few of them started to show themselves, but I went, it was probably within a year and a half period that I collected everything, and some of it I didn't finish until last minute in the studio. I knew I wanted to get in there, I wanted to be involved in it, so I asked Gordy, who I had a really good working relationship with and who has a studio in Austin, if we could do it together. And so I used a lot of my band members, some of the Heathens guys, and just some Austin local guys that I've known for a long time. So it just felt very organic, and it was a personal record for me, and I just wanted to be as involved as possible and be able to experiment and kind of make sure I said what I wanted to say. And that was a really great environment for that.
How is it a personal record for you?
Well, a lot of these songs are reminders to myself, which I've never done before. I'm usually not writing songs for myself so much. I was talking earlier about when I was a kid, like trying to keep running into the same thing. Like, I want to be different. I want to be happier, cooler, more productive, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't work. And moving to Arkansas gave me a chance to reset, sort of. And that was a cheap way to do it, just geographically changing location. But it worked. And then similarly, for a lot of my life, I have a hard time being present. I have a hard time calming my mind, stilling it. I have a hard time feeling secure, or have a hard time with anxiety. I have a hard time with a lot of things that had gotten really frustrating. And I just got sick of it and was trying to figure out a way for myself to just be a little more at ease in this world. I have an amazing life. Mm-hmm. I'm blessed in so many ways. And I thought, there's just the corollary between what's real and how I feel, that gap is wide and doesn't make sense to me. And I need to figure it out before any more time goes by, because we have a finite amount, and I'm just sick of this.
Sure.
So I wrote a lot of those songs just trying to figure out for myself where that stuff was coming from, and then sort of codify it into music and lyric in a way that, whether I'm playing it back, whether I'm playing it live or listening to it, that every time that happens, it's a reminder to me of these things.
Yeah.
Which are, trust yourself, believe in something higher than yourself, still your mind. You have everything you need within you. I mean, it's pretty rudimentary, basic stuff, but for me, I have to really hammer it home over and over and over again to slow down the train of my mind and my habits.
Sure. I love that. I mean, trying your best feels like failing a test. I think that I got that right. And We're Only Human.
Oh, yeah. So whether you give up or give it your best, it's hard not to feel like you're failing the test.
Yeah. Yeah. And then even sonically, like if it's on the piano, it's a bit more like ballady, I feel like, than a lot of your previous stuff.
Yeah, piano's never really been a big feature of my records until this one. And that song is just, being alive, being human's hard.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are. I don't care what blessings you're given. We all struggle. I just was like, man, I need some grace. And then it hit me. It was like, well, are you giving yourself any grace? And I realized I wasn't. I was expecting things out of me that all I seemed to be looking at was this certain result, and not my experience, my history, my hurt, my surroundings, whatever it was. And so I just started thinking about the idea of grace and then giving that to others. It's like everybody pisses me off and everybody's opinions get on my nerves or offend me. And I judge. And then I'm like, okay, well, I'm judging this person based on that. But here's what I do all the time. Mm-hmm. And here's the mistakes I make. Mm-hmm. And so they have every right to judge me. And where is this getting anybody?
Yeah.
You know? And so just trying to, part of the theme of the record and part of something I believe in life is you do a lot better trying to see the good in somebody, see them as a person, see them in whole and look for their best qualities. You'll do a lot better than if you're looking for their worst and not giving them grace or forgiveness or respect. Yeah. And so it's not always easy, but that's the idea of the song is like,
yeah,
it's not easy and we're all in it together in that way.
Yeah. I feel like Progress of Man is a different spin on it because it's still common. It's still like a human condition type of song.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm on the money there, but it feels like it's coming from the same place.
It's coming from the place. So it's a more judgmental song. So it's like on one hand, it's all about grace and forgiveness and understanding. But Progress of Man is just, I get overwhelmed by the world. You know, I try to pick up my phone and here's social media and all the careers and all the news and all the attention that they're trying to get from me.
Mm-hmm.
And then how am I supposed to feel about that? Do I engage with it? Do I interact with it? Am I jealous of it? Am I annoyed by it? And then the news and politics or marketing and what am I being sold?
Mm-hmm.
What life advice, what philosophy am I being pitched? Because mm-hmm. Everybody makes their money selling something to you.
Yep.
And that's just overwhelming mm-hmm. at times and leaves me very confused about what I'm supposed to do. And so another theme of this record is just coming back here. Mm-hmm. Okay, I recognize all that. It's out there.
Yeah.
Just because I see it doesn't mean I have to let it in. Doesn't mean I have to let it confuse me or disrupt my mind.
Yeah.
And so that song was just sort of born out of annoyance with everybody giving me their opinions about everything.
Yeah. And then High is just, and for context, by the time this interview comes out, the album will be out.
Okay.
But when we're talking right now, we have the three singles that are
sure.
that are released. So everybody go listen to the album. But High is just a good time, good feeling. And it's also on the piano. So sonically kind of lines up with We're Only Human. So
yeah. And that's a similar, it's one of those songs where I was stoned, just in life. I was stoned one night and that I said that to my wife. I said, I'm just the right amount of high, which I have a hard time with. I get anxiety and life. And particularly when I used to get high. And so that was a rare thing. And then I went and wrote it under those, that was the source for it, but it became about what I hoped to turn into is something not about drugs, but just about being present, still in your mind, mm-hmm. and having some peace and tranquility without the anxiety, without the worry, without the insecurity, without all that stuff that mm-hmm. just makes life not fun.
Yeah.
And so trying to cultivate that with ways other than drugs or through drugs. So that was one of those, that's a reminder for me, like there is this place you can get to and you know how to get there.
Yeah.
It's blocking out the noise, mm-hmm. getting quiet, getting still, connecting with yourself, and there's your own little heaven.
Yeah.
And that was a big realization for me. It was like, I can create my own heaven.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I thought I needed to take something, to get something, to do something.
Yeah.
To get it. And really what I need to do is get all that out of there because it's just right here within me.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's a reminder for that.
I'll be thinking about that next time I listen to it because I thought it was just about smoking.
It came from there. But yeah, like a lot of great ideas, they start with booze and alcohol, with booze and drugs.
Yeah. Well, kind of on the point of advice giving, or just a point of view that is positive, I wanted to ask you, let's say there's a kid or an adult who's like hundreds of miles from Nashville in a place like Crystal Beach, and they're just trying to make it happen somehow, but they don't know if they feel like they might need to go to Nashville. You're someone who did it not really coming to Nashville straight away.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you just have any advice for someone like that.
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to talk to about career advice, but what I will say is something Ray Wiley Hubbard told me really early on is that the song is everything. You know, if you don't have the songs, everything else is fool's gold. Yeah. You know, you may get a career, you may blow up, but it can fold in an instant. If you have the songs and you can stand by them, nobody can take that away from you. And does it mean you're going to get where you want to get career-wise? It doesn't mean you're going to get financially where you want to get. And I know those are huge parts, but if you're building the house of your career, start with what you can control, which is the work you do, the songwriting, the learning your instrument, learning your craft. And then you can go out wherever you go, and that's you. That's yours. Nobody gave that to you. You made that, and it can't be taken away. And then the thing that helped me was just going out. Like, I never, I lived in 4 cities where there was no music until I was 25, 26. Yeah. There weren't people to play with, really. There weren't bands, there weren't venues that are, you know, it was like there was no music scene, music culture. And when I finally got around or got to towns where there was clubs and people playing, I went out as much as I could. And like, what I realized is nothing ever happens sitting at home. And that doesn't mean for your own work, do your work, take all the time you need.
Yeah.
But going out and meeting people, people that could teach me something, people I could get inspired by, people that I just had fun hanging out with, and building that community, and wherever you are, I value that so much now. But as I look back, whether it's my people in Galveston or my people in Houston or my people in Austin or wherever I was, going through, just going out playing clubs. That's how I got my record deal. That's how I got every record deal I've ever had was stemmed from I'm gonna take a chance. I'm gonna send this to this label. I'm gonna go play this show. I'm gonna do this thing, and people have a chance of seeing you that they don't. And I guess that can apply to social media now, which is probably a more effective way than actually going out to a club. But again, I'm the wrong guy to ask. But for me, that was the thing, was just doing something, work on my craft, and then go work as much as I could to be around people that had what I wanted, or that that represented something that I wanted, which was to be in the music world.
Yeah.
And then great opportunities came out of that.
Yeah. No, thank you. That's a perfect answer. Thank you for your time. Really, really appreciate it. And awesome to get more context about sort of the Texas roots and the album coming out. We're Only Human. Again, it's out now, so everybody go listen to it. And also, you're going to tour off of it, correct?
Yeah.
Afterwards? Okay.
Yeah,
we'll pretty extensively.
We'll start, September, October, November, December. Yeah, okay. For the next 6 months, I'll be.
Awesome. Great.
Yeah, touring.
Well, I knew I wasn't going to be good at ending this, but thank you again for your time.
Ta-da!
Ta-da!